I'm standing on a bridge over the Izonzo Valley, the Valley of the Soča, as this river is called in Slovenia. Above us are the sort of grey, granity colours of the mountains around us, and down towards the bottom of the slopes, beautiful green woodlands. And below us is the sort of churning waters of the Soča. They have an emerald colour, which is almost unreal. And what's extraordinary is to imagine this place as a battlefield, because looking at it now, it's pure picture postcard. It's a holiday landscape, you know, crossed by this beautiful emerald river. And to think of this place as a region of war and destruction is really quite an effort of imagination. There was a Slovenian poet, Simon Grigorčić, who loved this river and who predicted in an almost sort of supernatural way what was going to happen in this place.
How beautiful you are, daughter of the mountains. So graceful in your natural beauty. Your diaphanous depths are not troubled by the tempest rage. Yet, alas, you poor one. Fearful tempests, terrible storms are threatening you. Clear sky above you, hail of bullets around you, and rain of blood and stream of tears. Blood will run knee-deep. Our blood will feed you. Enemy blood will spoil you.
Grigorčić was a local poet who wrote these words some 40 years before the First World War came to this place. And it was on this mountainous front that Italy and Austria-Hungary fought over the lands of the Slovenian plateau. The battles that raged here between June 1915 and November 1917 left deep scars that can still be seen in the landscape today. There was nothing preordained about the Italian decision to go to war in 1915. Until the outbreak of hostilities, Italy was formally a member of the Triple Alliance with Austria-Hungary and Germany. But she had also signed a secret pre-war agreement with France. At first, neutrality seemed the best option. But as the war gained momentum, Italy's leaders called in offers from both alliance blocs. Then, in April 1915, the Minister of Foreign Affairs, Sidney Sonnino, signed the London Pact, which promised that after an Allied victory, Italy would receive substantial new territories adjoining its northeastern borders.
You have to remember the condition that the Allies were in late 1914, early 1915.
Mark Thompson, author of The White War, Life and Death on the Italian Front.
They were bogged down on the Western Front. They didn't know what to make of what had happened to them. So the prospect of Italy throwing its weight in on their side against one of the two key enemy powers was hugely attractive. So the Allies were really prone to promise whatever Italy wanted.
What sorts of expectations do they have? They've seen what's going on the Western Front. Do they imagine this is going to be a long war that will cost hundreds of thousands of lives, or do they think it'll be over quickly? What picture do they draw for themselves of the war to come?
Insofar as a coherent picture was drawn, and I don't really think there was one, it consisted of happy anticipation of a rapid march across the Slovene flatlands towards Vienna. Once the easternmost Alps had been surmounted, and the deputy chief of the general staff said there was no reason why Italy shouldn't be in Vienna for Christmas.
In fact, fighting in this harsh, mountainous terrain was extremely demanding. Getting to Vienna for Christmas was out of the question. The novelist Emilio Gadda captured the exigencies of this battlescape when he wrote of the warring generals who scraped their massacred battalions over those hills like matchsticks. I'm standing on the Kolovrat Ridge and I'm looking out over an impossibly picturesque valley bisected by this blue-green river, the Izonzo, which cuts this valley in half. This was all Austro-Hungarian territory before 1914, but when the Italians entered the war, the Austrians withdrew to the peaks in front of us here. Directly in front of me I can see the sort of spiky alpine summit of Mount Körn, and over to the left what the Italians called Monte Canino. And it was along those peaks that the Austrians arranged their lines because they wanted to occupy the commanding heights from which they could control any battlefront that might develop here. The Italians, after they entered the war, pushed up onto these peaks at great human cost. And by 1917, the Austrian and Italian lines ran along this line of peaks. It's impossible to imagine how men managed to sustain these emplacements. They had to supply themselves with food, with munitions, and of course they had to haul their weapons, often very heavy field artillery, up these almost vertical mountainsides to emplacements on the summits.
When you're attempting to conduct a frontal infantry attack up, let's say, a 20, 30 degree slope against an enemy who has complete sight of all your positions and lines, but which you cannot see because it's behind the top of the escarpment, then the bloodletting was bound to be terrible.
So this is not the sort of soft earth and mud of the Western Front. This is warfare on a gigantic bed of pumice-like stone.
Essentially, yes, it's stone, very near the surface. Trenches usually had to be blasted out of the rock. And for the first year or so, there were no rock drills for the Italians which could do that for them. So this was a terrain in which all aspects of warfare were extremely arduous.
Oh, my goodness. I've just walked down a sort of a kind of corridor cut into the living stone of the mountain and reinforced with bricks and mortar. And we're now effectively underground and walking through the fabric of this ridge along a narrow entrenchment in almost total darkness, climbing some steps. It's getting lighter now. And emerging into a sort of viewing station from which we can look out across the valley, but without being seen, because there's a sort of parapet above us which would keep one's face in shadow. But it's an extraordinary example of the immense feats of engineering that were required to make these mountains defensible in wartime. This front saw the highest fighting in the history of modern warfare. In the high Alps around the Dolomites at the western end of the Italian-Austrian front, troops fought at altitudes of up to 12,000 feet in temperatures as low as minus 30 degrees centigrade. They had to dig into glaciers to secure their positions. And even today, 100 years later, the ever-warmer summers release corpses and other material from their icy tombs. As if these environmental challenges were not enough, the Italian troops also faced the harshest regime of military punishments anywhere in Europe. General Cadorna, chief of the Italian General Staff, ran a ferocious military regime. Regiments that failed to rise to Cadorna's often unrealistic expectations were sometimes collectively punished through decimation, the random execution of one-tenth of the regiment's strength. But for patriotically minded Italian troops, the Isonzo Valley was not just a place of pain and suffering. It also offered the promise of individual redemption. On a quiet morning in August 1916, the poet Giuseppe Ungaretti stripped off his filthy clothes and bathed in the emerald waters of the Isonzo River.
This morning I lay back in an urn of water and like a relic took my rest. The Isonzo's flow smoothed me like a stone of its own. This is the Isonzo, and here I best recognize myself, a yielding fiber of the universe.
This poem is not about the pity of war in the manner of the British war poets Wilfred Owen or Siegfried Sassoon. Instead, it merges the identity of the soldier with the landscape he has been sent to conquer. The long sequence of battles for the Isonzo, there were 12 of them in all, reached a climax in October and November 1917 with the Austrian counteroffensive that at last succeeded in driving the Italians back. Revolution had knocked Russia out of the war so that German units released from their duties on the Eastern Front could now reinforce the Austrian positions. Two attacking columns converged on the town of Caporetto, leaving detachments of Italians stranded with their gun emplacements on the mountain peaks. Back in Slovenia, local historian Jelko Cimbric showed me the scene of the helter-skelter Italian retreat across the Isonzo River.
On the left bank of the river, there were two German battalions, the Schleswig battalions, approaching the bridge, and then the Italians blew it up. And before the Germans arrived, they were dumping, throwing the cannons in the gorge of the river, not to become the booty for the enemy.
And what became of these cannons? Where are they now?
Well, they are still in the river. The cannons are still in the river.
Such was the momentum of the counterattack that the Italians were not just pushed off the mountains and onto the plain, but rolled back about 90 miles towards Venice. There were fears that Italy would be knocked out of the war. Only in October and November 1918 did the Italian armies push back eastwards across the Isonzo, assisted by three British and two French divisions, whose men could be spared from the Western Front now that the Americans had begun arriving in large numbers. When peace came at last in 1918, the Italians were on the side of the victors. Prime Minister Vittorio Orlando was present at the Paris Peace Conference to fight the Italian corner, yet the Italians never got what they'd been promised under the terms of the Pact of London. The formerly Austrian sectors of the Adriatic coast went to the new Yugoslavian kingdom, and Italy had to make do with Istria on the coast of Croatia and a portion of what is today Western Slovenia. They got the Isonzo Valley, but not much else.
The Italians were victors who felt like losers and felt that they'd been cheated. They somehow felt cheated.
Mark Thompson again.
The discontent of veterans coming back to, and as they felt, an ungrateful society which didn't want them and didn't want to recognise what they'd been through, also added to those pressures. And the road really was open for Mussolini's virtual putsch in 1922.
But can you tell us something about the significance of this war for Mussolini himself?
Yes, Mussolini mythologised the war as the experience which had made modern Italy great. That Italy sat at the sort of top table of European powers because of its sacrifice and achievements during the war. And he owed some of his success to the fact that he was telling veterans and telling Italians to be proud of what they'd done.
Benito Mussolini reclaimed the memory of the war in order to heighten the appeal of his movement. And today in Western Slovenia, you can still see how the fascist regime used monuments to the dead to lay claim to the landscape in the name of Italian patriot memory. This is the Italian charnel house, a church which has been placed on top of a hill in a very commanding position. The bones of over 7,000 Italian soldiers are kept here in the ossuary. What's interesting about this place is that it was actually inaugurated in 1938 in the fascist era by the Italians, and Mussolini was present here on that occasion, narrowly managed to escape an attempt to assassinate him. And so what we have here is effectively an overlaying of different memories, of different layers of significance, a site which had achieved a rather gloomy importance in the First World War as the place where so many Italian soldiers had died, was re-sacralized during the fascist era and became a symbol of fascism's claims to preeminence in Italy and the wider world. The entire site is beautifully situated because this church backs onto an extraordinary view over the Isonzo, the river front for which so many Italians fought and died during the First World War.